Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
You know, it's a cliche that a picture is worth a thousand words. In Pete Souza's case, one of his pictures is worth 10,000 words. Really one of the great photojournalists on the planet. Pete's had a long, distinguished career in photojournalism, as well as the official photographer for two American presidents. He cataloged the Obama presidency. I travel with him quite a bit during those years. Now he has a book out of 300 of the 1.9 million photos he took during those years that really tell the story of the administration. He came to the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago to display and talk about that work. And we got a chance to sit down and talk about his extraordinary career and experiences chronicling history. Pete Souza, my old buddy, it's good to see you. I knew you before you were a cult figure, so I'm glad to see you. Thanks for being here and at the University of Chicago at the Institute of Politics. Looking forward to your presentation.
Hey man, I'm excited to be here.
So I want to ask you a bunch of questions that I should have asked you all those times when we were sitting around various places waiting for something to happen or flying on planes and so on. But I know that you grew up in Massachusetts, and I know that your family came originally from Portugal, from the Azores. So, but just tell me a little bit about how you grew up.
I was born in New Bedford, which in the 1860s was actually the richest city in the world because of whaling. It was a big whaling port. But I grew up in South Dartmouth, which is just, I guess, a suburb, if you will, of New Bedford. My mom was a nurse, registered nurse. My dad was a boat mechanic. And both of them seemingly worked all the time. And it's funny, you look back now on their life. My mom's 91. My dad is deceased. But like my mom used to work the 11 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift when we were kids. And like I didn't think much of it then, but when you think about that now, she would get us off to school.
You had brothers and sisters?
I had a sister that was a couple years older than me. I had a younger sister, but I didn't really grow up with her. She was 12 years younger. So my mom would get us off to school in the morning after having just gotten back from work, you know, and get us off to school, make us breakfast, and then she would take a nap and then be there when we got home from school at 3:30. Then she would make us dinner and get us to bed. And then she would leave the house at 10:30 and go work the overnight shift. And when you think about that now, it's like, my God, how, like, it's just, it's almost disbelief that she actually functioned like that. You know, most of the time she was working at St. Luke's Hospital in New Bedford, but then she switched and worked at a nursing home in Dartmouth. And you talk about full circle. She's doing this rehab, because she just had, somewhat of a health setback. So she's doing a rehab at the same nursing home that she used to work at.
That's
which is like crazy to think about.
Well, it also speaks to how deep her roots in that community are.
Yeah.
So.
And then, like,
big Portuguese community in Massachusetts.
New Bedford was not so much Dartmouth. I was not a good student. I was probably like the least likely person to succeed in my high school.
Were you officially voted that, or do you think that was just a consensus thing?
Well, I think that was probably a consensus thing.
Yeah. When did this interest in photography begin?
So I went to Boston University after my guidance counselor urged me not to apply there because he said I would never get in. My grades weren't good enough. My SAT scores were not. And just despite him, I applied anyway. And
I had, by the way, that same experience at the University of Chicago. They told me, don't apply.
Yeah.
You won't get in. I did get in and then went and spent the next 4 years proving why I shouldn't have been admitted. But anyway.
It's funny because I actually did better in college than I did in high school. I went there because I was a huge sports fan, but I was not a good athlete. So I decided I was going to become a sports writer. That was my goal. And so I applied to the journalism school. It was called the School of Public Communication. It's now the College of Communication. And with the hopes of becoming a sports writer. And then in my junior year, I took a photography class. And it was almost probably the first time that after I had developed a roll of film and I'm making the print in the darkroom in that tray of developer, and when that first image appeared, I was hooked. And I was like, okay, this is magic. I want to do this.
You know, we should say, I think you know that there are a lot of people listening who are wondering what you mean when you say a roll of film and developing and all of that. That was a part of the quaint.
Different era.
Yeah.
Different era.
But, you know, it strikes me you, your photos are, I mean, you're a friend and we went on a journey together, so I have some bias, but your photos are spectacular. And, you know, there's that old thing about a picture is worth a thousand words. Pictures are... really do tell the story in ways that words only can partially tell.
I think, photographs not only capturing a decisive moment, but trying to authentically portray the mood and the emotion of what's taking place. I think it's sometimes... you can do that better with a photograph. If the person looking at the photograph feels that same thing. I mean, photography is subjective more so than words. And you've got to capture people's attention so they could sort of feel what maybe you were trying to show.
I watched you work quite a bit. And I would watch you silently move around rooms because part of what your job was to be as inobtrusive as possible as you were photographing, you know, often historic scenes, sometimes not historic but meaningful. And so what are the calculations that you're making when you're picking the spot you want to shoot from, when you're framing up the photo? What are the calculations that you go through to get to the point where you have a photo that actually says something?
So hard to articulate that.
That's why you're a photographer.
I feel that even though I was a seasoned guy, as they say, during the Obama administration, I felt that was a huge advantage in... having had so many experiences in photography and photojournalism, that I was sort of unfazed by all the power that was before me. That was really helpful to have the confidence to be there, that I know I needed to be there, and that I had the trust of Barack Obama to allow me to be there, because he could have, you know, made it difficult for me, and he didn't. And I think that the fact that he had the trust in me, it made it hard for anyone else to question why I was in the room. And that was, that's the hardest thing to get over, is you got to be there. You can't like write about it afterwards. You know, a reporter can interview people in the room afterwards. They wouldn't have to be in the room.
Right. But a moment is a moment.
But a moment is a moment. You've got to be there. So the fact that I had that trust from President Obama, that meant everything. In terms of, like, you know, moving around and trying to frame a picture and waiting for, anticipating the moment and clicking the camera at just the precise moment, and what to include in the frame, what not to include in the frame, that's like so hard to, as I said, articulate. It's intuition in so many ways.
You know, I made thousands probably of ads when I was doing that work as a political media person. And when I would then try and teach about it, it was interesting to me because you show these ads and you realize they're about a 100 different decision points about what images you use, what music you use, what type you use, you know, and of course the words you use, and there's a reason for everything you do that you don't even think about after a while, because it's instinctive. It's the product of a lot of experience. So on that note, let me ask you, you talked about being seasoned when you got to the Obama administration, but you started somewhere. I mean, you started at little newspapers in Kansas. What was it like then, as kind of a raw rookie photographer? What were the kinds of things that you were shooting then? What did you learn from that experience?
The great thing about newspapers, especially small newspapers in Kansas, is that you're doing something different every day. You're doing sometimes 3-4 assignments. So you learn to think quick, react quick, and still go into the dark room. As I said, this is like in the old days.
You got to develop the film and make
a print and all that. So it was trial by fire, and you know, you learn by making mistakes. Your name is under every picture in the newspaper. That's an incentive not to mess up, right? You don't want to put a bad picture and have your name under it. So I was always trying to make a good picture for every assignment, no matter how bad it was. And that's challenging, especially sometimes in Kansas, where, you know, if there's a dog that crosses the street at 1 o'clock, you know, that has a potential to be the page one photo, you know, because especially when you're in a town like Chanute, Kansas, you know, which we had a circulation of 6,000. And I went
right. But a lot of dog owners.
A lot of dog owners. But it's also I had a guy punch me out in Chanute, Kansas, because I was taking pictures of his factory on fire that police suspected he had started himself to collect insurance money. I had an irate father come and storm into the publisher's office because I had taken a picture of his son's automobile accident that killed someone that his son was responsible for. And, you know, why they lashed out at me, I don't know. I didn't kill the girl, his son did. But, you know, so things like that you realize your photographs do have an impact, even with a newspaper that only has a circulation of 6,000.
How'd you get up to Chicago? You wound up with the Chicago Sun-Times in the early 80s. In fact, I was working across the street at the time at the Tribune.
Yeah, I didn't know you, but I'll bet if I went back through all my old negatives, I'd see you in the background at, you know, some of the Harold Washington events that I covered. So somebody recommended me for a job to the Sun-Times. It was just like I got a call one day from Henry Gill, who is the director of photography at the Sun-Times, and he called me and he goes, "We want you to come interview." And I was like, "Well, I work every day. I can't." He goes, "No, we want you to come interview." So I flew up to Chicago and he hired me. And so I went from a 6,000 circulation daily to a 600,000 circulation daily.
And a city where probably the dog crossing at one was not going to make the front page.
No.
So how was that adjustment from small town Kansas to Chicago?
I have to say, having lived in Boston during my college days, I had been in a big city before, so that part of it was okay. But it was just the types of assignments you were getting, which were, you know, much bigger. You were covering major league sports, and you were covering, you know, spot news that was big spot news, and you were covering politics. I was there when Jane Byrne was the mayor, and I was covering her a lot, and covering the city council meetings and Ed Verdoliak, and like just
For people who don't know, I mean, this was kind of a crazy period in Chicago political history. Jane Byrne was this very interesting, kind of sometimes wacky, but tough woman who beat the Democratic organization of which she once was part, and then had this very tumultuous reign of 4 years as mayor. I covered City Hall for part of that.
I covered the end of her mayorship, and then a little bit of Harold Washington, you know, who eventually became the first African American mayor of Chicago.
Yeah, well, tell me about them as characters to shoot these people.
Well, I think you described Byrne fairly well. It was, you know, we never had like access to Byrne when she was like doing the real people's business. It was always these more public events that were all kind of like,
or doing business to the people,
or doing
some
business
suggested.
To the people, yeah. And then, you know, and Harold Washington was such a big personality. And,
wasn't he?
Oh,
someone was
gosh.
Just asking me about him today because we're coming right up on the 30th anniversary of his untimely death. He died at his desk at City Hall. Yeah. I've never met a more ebullient personality in politics. In fact, I often say, you know, I think that had he lived, that he and Barack Obama would have been friends. I think they would have had an interesting relationship, sort of mentor to mentee, because Harold was such an interesting character, but must have been incredibly fun to shoot.
Yeah, he was. He was. And then, you know, almost prematurely, I was offered a job in the Reagan White House.
How did that happen? First of all, I should point out that, you know, you came up from Kansas, and within a year and a half, you were named the Illinois Photographer of the Year. So, you know, obviously, you took to this pretty quickly. But making the leap from the Chicago Sun-Times to the White House is a pretty big leap. How did that happen?
It was totally unexpected. I actually turn it down at first.
Because, why?
Because I was in a really good situation in Chicago. I really felt that I was growing as a photojournalist. I was working with, you know, John White, the legendary
three-time Pulitzer Prize winner. Yeah,
and people like Richard Dirk and Perry Riddle. I mean, just pillars of photojournalism. And so it's great to be on that staff, it is a fairly small community. And the White House photo editor, who had been at the Kansas City Star, Carol Greenewalt, was following my career, she was working for Michael Evans, who was Reagan's chief photographer, and they had an opening. They actually had to dismiss someone. And so they had this opening in 1983, so the middle of Reagan's first term. And she just like called me up one day out of the blue and said, "We want you to apply for this job." And I'm like, you know, A, I was not really that into politics. B, I was really not the biggest fan of Reagan. But, you know, you hope that what you're doing is important for history, right? I used to say journalism is the first draft of history. And I'm thinking like, okay, here's a chance to actually really be involved in documenting history.
This is an important point because you approached these assignments and you worked in two White Houses, which bracketed a career in journalism. You don't see that much of a separation between the two. You see your job as the White House photographer as a form of photojournalism.
It is. I mean, there would be outrage by photojournalists to refer to me as a photojournalist within the White House. But I mean, like, I don't
send your emails to Pete Souza, by the way, all the photojournalists who are listening.
I don't like when you're at the White House as a White House photographer. It's not like you suddenly switch gears and you start using you start taking pictures differently. Or you change the style of how you take pictures. It's the same thing. Now, yes, I am on the government payroll, and I.
Well, the question is, I guess, were there occasions when in either White House when there were photos that you thought were worthy of public consumption that and a decision was made? Nah, we're not going to share that one.
Sure. I mean, during the Reagan administration. In 86 or 87, like this, I forget when Iran-Contra was going on. And I mean, I have some pictures that that I really feel reflected the mood, and the White House would not make them public. But when I published a book, Reagan himself was okay with me making them public.
This was 93,
because yeah.
After his administration.
After his administration, and you're putting things into context, right? Yeah. It's not like you're, putting them out at the time, which I understand why the White House would not want to.
Yeah. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with Pete Souza. What was Ronald Reagan like? You know,
So we're not really taking a break. It's just you're just saying that.
No, we
for
will
commercial.
Have.
We sorry, will, I'm just messing with you.
Well,
I get it.
We will have taken a break. Who knows? We may be promoting your book in ad form in that in between.
Sorry,
Little Brown wants to buy that slot. But anyway, tell me what Reagan was like, because that's still a mystery to this day. I mean, he has kind of mythic status now in American politics, and yet very few people seem to really know what he was like.
I wish I could tell you. I don't know that I know. If you talk to his son, I mean, I think he would say the same thing. Very difficult guy to get under his skin and really figure out what made him tick. I will say this, you know, the one aspect of his personality that was similar to President Obama is he was very even-tempered, and it would take a lot to get him really riled up, as it would President Obama. I did see him get riled up.
What kinds of things would rile him up?
So I'll give you an example. And you may have to give the background a little bit more, but there was this controversy when he accepted a visit from German Chancellor Kohl to go visit a cemetery in Bitburg.
Yes.
Which turns out the graves of SS soldiers were buried there, Hitler's elite guard, which when he accepted the invitation, he didn't, the White House didn't realize it. And then it was before the visit, uncovered. And he was being, everyone on the White House staff, Mrs. Reagan, your friend Elie Wiesel, telling him he could not go and visit there. And he had this stubborn reaction, which was, another head of state asked me to do this visit, and unless he rescinds the invitation, I'm going.
Yeah.
And, you know, he argued with his wife about it.
Which was unusual, at least in front of you.
Probably. Yeah. And it was like his he just felt that strongly about it. And so stuff like that. Yeah. He would get PO'd when people try to.
Yeah, and probably angry as presidents get when they feel like there's been bad staff work or.
Yeah. Or,
yeah.
And it's ironic. The staff work is such that there was a pre-advanced team. So that's a team that goes over months before to like sort of set the stage for the visit. And Mike Deaver was part of that pre-advanced team.
Deaver was the president's longtime aide who really was sort of the producer of the Reagan sort of public production.
So when he went to visit the cemetery, it was winter and the cemetery was filled with snow and they did not see the graves.
I see.
So, yeah.
So many of your photos of Reagan are with Nancy and they're very, very warm. I mean, that's the place where you really see him light up. Their relationship seemed almost as if they lived in a bubble of their own.
They were very close. It was not like a made-for-TV kind of a relationship. It was a real relationship. They truly did love each other. They were each other's best friends. He was not happy when she was out of town on a foreign trip. He was not happy when he was on a long foreign trip without her. It was really a partnership. Now I will say that she never got involved with policy, but she did very much get involved with personnel, as I think we all know now.
Mm-hmm. Do you you and I had spoken once about Reagan. I should ask you first before I get to this. I mean, you as a person, how did he treat you? How did he treat the people around him?
I've said this before. I respected him as a person. Like he was a decent human being. I didn't always agree like with his politics per se. But if he had not been like a decent human being and treated people with respect, I don't know that I could have, you know, stayed there. I was there the last 5.5 years of his administration. And I don't think I would have lasted that long if like I didn't respect him.
You were there for a long time. And we talked about this, you know, Reagan, it's no, obviously everyone now knows that he was older when he got there and he ultimately, had to deal with Alzheimer's, and there was some question as to the end of his administration, what the state of his acuity was. And you said that that the one thing you noticed was that he would take notes later in his administration.
You remember me telling you that?
I do, yeah. I remember everything you've ever told me. So
That's scary.
Except the things you asked me to forget. So tell me... Tell me about that.
So that was one of the things that I knew was that he did keep a diary. I mean, I had never seen it, but I knew that he, at the end of the day, he would go up to the residence and he would write in his diary. And sometimes it was short annotations, which we saw when the diary was
published. Yeah.
Published. He would get a pocket schedule, much like Barack Obama did, that he would keep in his suit coat. You know, it's just a very, what would you say, like 3 inches wide by 7 inches tall. And it would have a schedule on it. And I noticed the last, you know, now I forget if it was 6 months or last year or so, he would be in these meetings and he would occasionally write something on the back of his schedule. I had never seen him do that. In the first 4.5 years I was there, and I never asked him about it but I'm an observer. That's my job as a photographer. You're supposed to be an observer, and I observed that. And my suspicion was that he was getting up to the residence at night and maybe was not remembering details. Mm-hmm. Now, like, I could do that myself now and it would be helpful. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Because you tend to, even in your 50s and 60s, you tend to start, like, you know, remembering details.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's sort of like why James Comey wrote down notes after he had been in a meeting.
Well, he may have had a few other reasons for that.
He had a few other readings, but but the point being that
no, I understand.
He was trying to, you know, and whether that had anything to do with Alzheimer's or not. But
recognition that maybe he was failing a little. Yeah,
but I mean, he was in his
people don't under he was
he
in
was 77, I think.
Right, which I don't think the one thing that was really a revelation to me, and you knew this because you had been there, was just how exacting, just how tough being president of the United States is. I mean, you know, it's sort of a cliche to say, well, that's the hardest job on the planet, but until you see it and what comes to that desk every single hour of every single day and through the night and into the weekends unrelentingly, it is an unbelievable grind.
And the thing that I was always impressed with about, well, amongst the many things, but impressed with about, I mean, we're skip jumping up to the last administration with President Obama. Was but on that same tone is on these long Asia trips, and you know what those are like.
Yes.
They're brutal.
Yeah.
And when you're the guy that then has to go before all the cameras and answer questions and be able to articulate policy and answer, like for Barack Obama to do that with like having been on a trip for 10 days and not had good sleep and had these all-day meetings and still never mess up, I still...
And just, not send grouchy tweets at the end of the 12 days. That was another feature of that. So you, when you left the White House, you went to work for my old paper, for the Chicago Tribune. And one of your assignments was out of Washington, but you also covered some war, including Afghanistan. Was that your first experience with war coverage?
Before I went to Afghanistan and right after 9/11, I did cover the refugee crisis in Kosovo, and then when NATO finally crossed the border into Kosovo, I was with the NATO troops. And we had a few close calls in Kosovo, but nothing like Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, tell me about that and what that experience was like. I looked at some of your photos from that period, and I mean they're striking and incredible. The thing that there was one photo of a young child whose legs had been amputated that was just wrenching, but the faces of these children. Was the thing that struck me the most. But tell me what that experience was like.
Yeah, it was amazing, and in some ways was one of the more fulfilling things I've ever done in my career, because this was the first war where digital cameras were good enough. And even though there was very little electricity in Afghanistan, with a satellite phone, you could send images back. So I was, my images were appearing in the Tribune every day, and I was getting like hundreds of emails from readers, and I really felt that I was doing good work, and people were seeing it and paying attention to it. But it was a very treacherous trip. I came in. This is when the Pakistan border was still closed, and the U.S. had started an air campaign. And before any U.S. troops were even on the ground, I got into Afghanistan.
On horseback?
I crossed the river, I forget the name of the river, from Tajikistan in the north.
Mountains.
No, but this is before that. to actually get into Afghanistan, I had to cross a river on this little raft, and from Tajikistan, from the north. So that got us above the Hindu Kush Mountains. And then by horseback, we went over the Hindu Kush Mountains. And it was already, even though it was October, it was already winter there. There was like 3 feet of snow. It was like below zero once the sun went down. And, you know, it was like we almost froze to death on that mountain. And then we finally got into the Panjshir Valley, and we're close to Kabul. And our timing was impeccable because 4 days after we got outside of Kabul, the U.S. started really dropping B-52 bombs, and the Northern Alliance, which were the soldiers that we were supporting within Afghanistan fighting the Taliban, they made their final push into Kabul like 4 days after we got in the valley. So we were so like lucky to be there when all that happened. But there was like a lot of, you know,
that is the view of a journalist who say we were lucky to be there when it happened. A lot of people would say, gee, this is not very lucky to be here when this is happening.
But I was lucky in that, you know, I remember one time as we were walking along the front lines, and you could hear crystal clear sniper bullets from the Taliban whistling over your head, and you didn't know if it was 2 feet over your head or 20 feet over your head.
Yeah,
but it was like,
man, am I lucky?
I'm lucky. I'm lucky.
I want to get to the man who's the subject of the great and wonderful collection of photos that you just released, Obama, An Intimate Portrait. That experience began in 2005. The Chicago Tribune decided that they were going to, and I remember this because I was on the Obama end of things when they proposed this, they were going to follow him for a year as a new freshman senator in Washington on the theory that this guy was going places. You've said that was your impression almost from the minute that you saw him. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, you know, I had never met him. I was one of the few people who hadn't seen the 2004 convention speech because I was traveling with John Kerry.
It was good.
I know it was good. Yeah. I've since seen it, but at the time. And my only knowledge of him was the profile that The New Yorker had done. So that was my only like real sort of intimate knowledge about who this guy was. But two things struck me. One, right away, I met him on his first day in the Senate. That was the first time I had met him. And I'll show this picture tonight. Four or five is
late. You're going to be displaying these pictures for at the university here.
Yeah, tonight, yeah, and there's a couple pictures from the Senate days just to get us started.
That's a great picture of him running up the Senate steps.
Yeah, but the picture I'm referring to is there's a picture of him with Sasha and Malia. That very first day. So I've known the guy 4 hours. I'm tagging along with him. I'm not really talking to him much because that's not my job. He's, you know, it's kind of a ceremonial day. And he goes into this little office. And
he was a temporary space then. So,
yeah. And he had to quickly eat a sandwich because it was the only chance he was going to eat. So he's eating this sandwich, Sasha Malia with him. It's a very intimate picture. On this, you and I are about, what, 4 feet apart. I'm about this close to him. And I'm making this really intimate picture. And there's no recognition that I'm even there, that he's just like so comfortable in his own skin. And it's translated to Sasha and Malia, where they're not even paying attention to me. And I'm thinking, like, just because of that, I'm thinking this guy is a good subject for a photographer, because that's what you want. You don't want them to be self-conscious. You want to be able to capture whatever they're doing in a natural way. And I just saw that the first day. But then, more than anything, I saw how people were reacting to him and how he was able to connect with people, whether he was talking to them or whether he was, you know, more doing the not the grandstanding, but the retail kind of politics where you're just having a conversation with someone. He connected that way, and he connected when he was talking from a podium in a way that was really impressive right away.
You also saw him connect with people overseas. You went on two trips with him.
I did.
In that period, 2005, 2006, one to Russia and Eastern Europe. You guys actually got detained over there, I think.
We did get detained for three or four hours.
Yeah.
And I forget the name of the town, but it was in Russia. And, Jeff Zeleny was with me, a reporter for the Tribune. Now it's
CNN.
Yeah. Now it's CNN. And he somehow got a text message back to the editors in Chicago. And we had CNN up, of course, on the TV in this little airport, CNN International. And, nobody knew we were being detained. But Jeff got this text message out. And the next thing we know, we saw on the scroll bar, two senators detained in
Dick
Russia.
Luger from Indiana right, was Dick with Luger. You as well. The second trip was to Kenya. I should ask you about one in between. Were you with him when he went down to Katrina?
I was not. Yeah. I was not. I wish I had been there.
Yeah, that was an extraordinary. I wasn't there either.
I couldn't get the Tribune to pay for me to go. I really wanted to, but
I don't know which editor was responsible for that. But I hope they're listening right now. Kenya and Africa. The Africa trip in 2006, in the summer of 2006. That was an extraordinary spectacle, really.
Well, we first went to South Africa, and he, amongst other things, went and visited Nelson Mandela's cell.
You shot some extraordinary photos of him in that cell on Robben Island.
Yeah, that was amazing. Well, and then he went to Kenya to go to the village where his grandmother lived, and that was crazy. I mean, I don't know how else to say, because like the entire village pulled out. I remember before we even went to his grandmother's village, we were in, I'm trying to think of the name of the town, but he wanted to do a public AIDS test, have his blood tested to encourage others to do it. And there were like thousands of people like there to watch. They're sitting in the trees. People are yelling. It was like crazy. Crazy, out of control, excitement. There wasn't like violence.
But it did speak to the fact that he was kind of a transcendent figure, even as a young senator, particularly because of his ties to Africa.
Yeah. And then the family joined him at Masai Mara, and they went on a safari. Which was incredible too.
You joined him. You were. Let me take a short break, and we'll be right back with Pete Souza. You joined the administration from the beginning. Did you have any second thoughts about doing that? I mean, you had done this before. Now you were re-upping. And you did it as a young man. Now you were seasoned, as you said before.
Well, and I never had the desire to do it again. But I often thought to myself, well, if I ever do this again, I want to be the head guy, and I want to really do it the way it's supposed to be done. And there was a guy who I had always admired. I never met him, Yoshi Okamoto. His nickname was Oki, and he was LBJ's photographer. And he was probably the first official White House photographer to truly document a president for history. He had like access to everything. And so that was the approach I wanted to take. And I remember when Robert Gibbs, your friend and colleague, was calling me as the emissary for the president-elect. And when he called me to offer me the job, I said, well, I definitely want to do this, but I need to have access to everything. And I remember he just said, the president-elect gets it. That was it. I mean, that was the essence of that conversation.
It's funny you should mention the LBJ photos and the LBJ administration, because so many of those photos that came out of the White House really reflected the stress of those times, of the Vietnam War, of the civil rights battles and so on. A lot of it was LBJ working, and a lot of it was LBJ anguishing as he worked. And you captured a lot of that. President Obama came to office in some very stressful times, greatest economic crisis since the Great Depression, two wars. There was a lot of tension, and a lot of your photos reflect that.
And I was saying to someone the other day that the administration made the decision early on to make a lot of these pictures public right away, with social media. We used the Flickr photo stream. And
First administration. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I guess it was the first time it was available.
And I suspect that no matter who had been president, who had been the photographer, a different president and a different photographer would have done the same thing. But we were trying to be authentic. So a lot of the pictures, especially in 2009, 2010, reflected that, as you call it, anguish, and were subsequently, and years to come, used out of context in political ads, which is the risk that you take when you release pictures like that.
Yeah, yeah. There were moments of triumph too, and one I love is him walking off the podium. He went to Baltimore to speak to the Republican House Caucus.
Oh, I love that picture.
And and it was broadcast because we asked for it to be broadcast.
Right.
And he had essentially a live debate over healthcare with the Republican caucus, and he's leaving and knowing
he's just cleaned their clocks.
And he knew it. And you can see it on his face. And he's brushing past a very stoic Mike Pence.
Yeah. I love that picture because that one, to me, accurately reflected what had just happened, where I think the Republicans were stunned that this guy knew a hell of a lot more about the healthcare bill and healthcare in general than all of them put together.
Yeah, I don't think he was ever invited back, certainly not with cameras.
Not live TV.
Yeah, not with cameras. Maybe the most famous photo you ever shot was in May of 2011, on the day of the Bin Laden raid. And I think people have seen that photo, but describe that photo the way you see it through, the way you saw it through your lens and the way you saw the moment.
As you know, the Situation Room is comprised of three conference rooms. The president's always in the big conference room, but the communications link set up for this raid was in this little tiny conference room across the hall. So everybody just like piled in there, and they're really, it's jammed in this room, and the president's not even seated at the head of the table because there was a brigadier general on a laptop who is in direct communication with I believe Admiral McRaven, who was in Afghanistan. And so he was ready to give up his chair for President Obama, and the president's like, no, you stay right where you are. I'll just pull up a chair next to you. But so everyone is monitoring this raid as it's happening for 40 minutes, usually in a Situation Room meeting. There's lots of discussion back and forth. The president's talking, Secretary of State's talking. Sometimes there's arguments, sometimes there's policy differences. They're hashing it all out. For 40 minutes, there was no discussion. There was observation, including by me. And they were observing what was taking place on the screen, and I was observing them watching it. And I think if you look at all those tense faces, you see the tension that was in that room. And one of the reasons why is you have the most powerful people in the federal government all jammed into this room. and they're essentially powerless. They cannot affect in any way the outcome of what they're watching. It's up to those guys on the ground. And I think it was somewhat of a, you know, a helpless feeling, because you want to help in some way, but you can't. They had already made their decision in the days and weeks before, and now they're just there.
Now, was that moment that you shot that photo, was that during the period of time when the helicopter had crashed, or was it after that?
It was not when the helicopter crashed. I can't tell you exactly when it was, but in looking at the line by line of the mission itself, and one of the good things about a digital camera is everything
you
is time-stamped.
Yeah.
So it was towards the end of the mission, and what I'm pretty sure it was when the special forces were inside the house and there was no direct link to what was going on. And so I think that they were waiting for them to come out of the house, hopefully all intact. Because, like, you know, this thing could have gone really wrong. I mean, there a helicopter crashed right away, and Admiral McRaven, being the genius that he was, had backup helicopters nearby, and the pilot, being the genius pilot that he was, crashed that helicopter in a way that no one got hurt, which is amazing when you think about it. But it could have gone really bad, that mission, as sometimes happens.
What an incredible thing to, I mean, there probably isn't anybody else who witnessed as much history other than the president himself than you.
I've seen a lot.
Yeah. Some of the photos that were most impactful were not these big historic occasions, but poignant ones, like the photo which I have in my office of the little boy touching the president's hair in the Oval Office. Explain that photo and what you were thinking when you took it.
So the little boy was Jacob Philadelphia. He was 4 years old at the time. His dad was a Foreign Service worker who had non-political, so had worked during the Bush administration, carried over to Obama, had come in with his family into the Oval Office for a family photo with the president standing in front of the desk. They finished the photo. The mom says, "Mr. President, Jacob has a question for you." And Jacob, you know, imagine being 4 years old talking to the president of the United States. So it's kind of more of a whisper about you know, his friend said that his hair is like his, and the president bends over and says, "Go ahead and touch it." And you have this little four-year-old boy touching the head, feeling the head of the president of the United States, who's bending over at the waist in front of him. And Jacob's eyes are just glued right to the president's head as he's touching him. And it was, I shot one frame of that. It happened so fast. It was unexpected. And I didn't even know for sure that I had the picture until later that night. And I think it later resonated with so many people, mostly because people could imagine a four-year-old African-American kid touching the head of the president of the United States, who looks like him.
Yeah.
And I think that resonated.
It said, you talk about a picture that says everything.
It does. But, you know, here's the thing, Axe. This also tells you a lot about the president of the United States. That at the behest of a four-year-old kid, that he would bend over like that and let this kid just touch his head.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that the current president is unlikely to bend over and ask a four-year-old to touch his hair. I don't think that's going to happen.
I won't comment.
I'm just guessing. Another one that I really love that's in your collection is him walking through. It looks like it's in the OEOB next door and giving a fist pump to a janitor as he walked by. Which I think is not, those kinds of exchanges weren't that extraordinary because we've seen them, you know, whenever he traveled, he always went through the bowels of a hotel and there were always people, hotel workers waiting and he would stop. But that's another thing that people don't expect.
No. And we were walking either to or from an event in the old executive office building, which is within the White House complex. Here's a funny anecdote about that picture. The guy's name is Larry Lipscomb, and I had a photo editor who would look through every single picture that I took. And at the time, it was Alice Capriner. She was there for the first 2.5 years, I think, and she was looking at my take that day, every single frame, and she came across this picture, and she said, "This is the guy that takes out our trash." Huh. You know, that comes to our office and takes out our trash. And it struck her that she was living history, too, in a different kind of way. And that picture became emotional for her, that she knew this guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You know, those of us who worked with the president and were around those years know that you were more than his photographer. You were a companion. You were with him a lot. You were in his card-playing quartet on these long plane rides, playing spades, probably more spades than you actually wanted to play. Pete's nodding right now, hoping that the president isn't listening to the podcast. What changes did you see in him over the course of those 8 years?
I have to say that from the time that I knew him as a United States Senator until, you know, January 20th of this past year and beyond, the core character of the man has not changed. I really believe that. I mean, I think he always was thinking about what's the right thing to do for people, you know. And I think I got to say that I wonder if anyone that wants to be president maybe should be a community organizer for a couple years as a requirement, as a prerequisite, because I think that's one way he was able to. I don't think he ever lost the connection that he had with those people in Chicago. And I think that, you know, in the same way that Joe Biden never lost the connection he had with people in Scranton, I think that's a good background to have when you're at the highest levels of government. Don't you think?
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah. And I think the fact that the truth is he wasn't that removed from his own working class journey when he became a United States Senator and then president. I mean, he had just paid off his student loans when he went to the Senate. I think there's something to be said for that as well. What I noticed was I knew him for years before he became a senator, a president. And I tell everyone that the night he was elected president, I went into his suite with Robert Gibbs and David Plouffe, and you could almost see the sort of weight of the responsibility descend on his shoulders. And I see him now,
and that weight's gone.
It is. It's sort of remarkable.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I've been with him a couple times. I was at the summit with him, and then I went down to Texas for that benefit concert for hurricane victims. Mm-hmm. So I flew on his plane. I asked if I could go because I thought, you know, this might be the last time all five formers are together.
Yeah.
So I thought from a historical standpoint, I should photograph that.
Yeah.
You know, so I was on the plane for, you know, 2.5 hours going down, 2.5 hours going back. And you could see the weight was gone, the weight of everything that you do and say is on your shoulders, no matter what happens in the country and in the world. it affects you when you're the president of the United States.
Now you become, I joked at the beginning, but I'm only half kidding. You're kind of a cult figure now, in part because of your Instagram site. You've been posting pictures from the Obama years during this first 10 months, 11 months of the Trump administration, and they all seem to have an unspoken message. So tell me what you have in mind here.
I didn't have anything in mind. It's like people think I'm like, you know, I had some grand strategy. I didn't. I just almost began accidentally. And the one thing that I was trying to maintain is being as subtle as I could, and not being like, you know, the Pod Save America guys.
Our old buddies, yeah.
Yeah. And just, you know, reminding folks about what the last administration was like. And to do it in a way, as I say, was respectful and playful at times. And let it speak for itself. I mean, I had all these people wanting to interview me about this the last, you know, 6 or 8 months. And I never did one interview because I thought that would, you know, make it less effective. Matter of fact, early on, people started writing stories, even though I wouldn't be interviewed. And I remember the first time I saw the headline, you know, Obama photographer throws shade at Trump. I had to, like, actually look up what throw shade means, you know.
You clearly aren't a Pod Save America.
No, you know, so, but, like, look, compared to, I mean, I think I'm so subtle and respectful on Instagram, especially when you compare it to what some people write on Twitter.
Yeah. Why are you looking at me, man?
Nothing. I'm not looking at you.
Let me just ask as we close.
I'm not talking about you, X.
What's next for you? I mean, obviously right now you're traveling with this book, and again, Obama, An Intimate Portrait. I mean, I'm biased and I confess it, but it really is an emotional experience to go through these photos and a great look at history as well as at the man. But now what? I always, you know, the question is always like, what are you going to do to match this?
Man, you're putting that kind of pressure on me.
Yeah. I was like, you hit the impossible question on the way out the door.
Yeah, I mean, I got a lot of thoughts swirling around in my head, and I got to figure that out. I mean, this year, just getting this book together, producing it, getting it designed and printed the way I wanted, and so this has been a book year, as I say, and I haven't done that much photography. I did something for Netflix with Kevin Spacey, of all people, in promotion of the new season of House of Cards. I did something with my friend Brandi Carlile, who's a musician in Seattle, and I did some pictures for her upcoming record. And I've done a couple other assignments like that. But I gotta figure out what my next big project is.
Well, I have to tell you that your photos, one of your photos of Bruce Springsteen that you shot from the mosh pit on your, I think you may have done it on your phone. I'm not sure. Not on your phone, but it wasn't. You didn't have your.
No, I had like a mirrorless, almost a point and shoot with me.
Yeah,
but I was like,
fantastic,
you know,
photo,
yeah,
though.
That's
you,
good
listen.
One.
You are you're really, really one of the great photographers of our time, and as good a man. So it's been great to know you, and it's been great to talk to you.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it very much, and I'm looking forward to tonight's event.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.